Item number 9 is a presentation. We had requested this after a number of projects that have come before the commission that are being constructed near freeways, and it has created kind of ongoing questions about how do we provide space for private landowners to develop their land and maximize the public health as a result of that development and minimize any ill effects. So we have been doing that on a case-by-case basis, and staff is going to provide today more of a kind of comprehensive idea of how we might approach those in the near future. And this is a conversation. I don't believe we're moving to adopt anything today. It's more of a conversation so that we begin to educate ourselves about the tools in our tool chest and highlight any tools we should maybe develop. So with that, I'm going to invite staff. How long will you need to present on this item?
10 minutes.
Okay. So provided, please proceed when you're ready.
Great. We're just waiting for the technology to catch up with us here. Just bear with us for a moment. Good afternoon. It's still good morning. Actually, Sean is going to go make some comments copies for you.
Great.
You'll have it in front of you. I have it on my iPad, my new mobile office. So I'm going to get started. I'm Claire Bowen with the City Planning Department, and I am joined by Principal City Planner Shawna Bonston. Oh, looks like we actually have our up and running. So anyway, thank you for having us come today to speak with you about this important topic. I think it's very relevant given some of the conversations you actually were already initiating about clean air and electrical vehicle charging stations in your last project. I think it is really important to establish for the beginning that the region of Southern California has had poor air quality for a long period of time. We are continue to be in non-attainment on a number of particle types, and based depending on the particle types, there are places where they've identified there really is no distinction between areas that are either immediately adjacent to the freeway and other parts of the city. So there, again, there's kind of a general poor air quality that I think we're all familiar with here in Southern California. Although there are, for things like ozone and ultrafine particles, there is a level of distinction that it is worse near the freeway areas. For this report, we've done a lot of studies. We've looked at a lot of studies that have been done about, again, the particular particles that particularly influence the air quality around freeways to help us identify what might be opportunities to help try to improve that situation. Should we go? I'm just trying to get the slide. So we looked at a number of studies, again, that have been done looking at different air quality studies. Oops. There we go. Excellent. Yeah, our director to the rescue. So one of the challenges that I want to just point out to you about freeways is that, or particles, and again, that are particularly near freeways, is that they respond differently at different times of the day. They respond differently based on different winds. How far you are from the freeway obviously affects your exposure. But again, the time of day, the year, these particles typically will fall. They tend to be fairly heavy. But again, on a hotter day or a day with a lot of wind, they might actually become more airborne. They also, because they are oftentimes gases, they are very fine, they will penetrate through buildings. So I think what I'm trying to just help you understand here is that the challenge of creating kind of project-specific solutions to dealing with these issues is very challenging. I want to kind of step back, though, at this moment and just kind of share with you, again, some of the detailed reports that we have seen. This has obviously been an issue for a long time, and I particularly want to focus on the Center for Disease Control's report that came out back in 2010. And they really are focusing, again, because of a lot of the challenges that I just described, of actually kind of, again, trying to mitigate and reduce exposure at the site, they're really focusing on how do we reduce mobile source emissions to start with. And I think this is where the City of Los Angeles has obviously been a leader over the last number of years in trying to promote our transportation system, increasing the proximity people have to walking, to the to tacos, to their local store, to their schools, things that help us get us out of our car, things that adding bicycle lanes, promoting more walkability in the city. These are the kinds of things globally that are going to do the most benefit for the city as a whole in terms of reducing our mobile source emissions and basically improving our air quality. Things that the port has done in terms of diesel vehicles, all those things collectively are moving us forward in terms of improving the air quality. One of the other things is, again, about moving us away from not only reducing the vehicle miles, but also then helping change the fleet from more of a gas-powered fleet to more an electrical vehicle fleet. And so we're going to talk more about that, because that is one area where, again, kind of looking at our toolbox, we might have an opportunity to begin to try to support the infrastructure investments around electrical vehicle charging stations, because they really do help, again, with this idea of reducing mobile source emissions. The area that I think you're, though, particularly interested in, though, again, is back to this issue of, well, how can we reduce exposure to more mobile source emissions? And clearly the more challenging part of the conversation. The two things here in red are, again, the areas that the Center for Disease Control report focused on as kind of being the, well, fairly limited, but the two areas of focus that they've looked at where they maybe are able to kind of help reduce that exposure. And again, those are around roadside barriers and improved ventilation systems, and then the secondly around land use policies. So I'm going to walk through both of those items. So on reducing exposure, so the barriers, the zoning information item that we already have out does already begin to talk about putting in more vegetative screening near our buildings that are adjacent to freeways. And certainly, we know that there's a lot of benefits to landscaping just in general. It provides more cooling. It helps create shade. It does do kind of carbon sequestration. It helps absorb stormwater. What we don't know definitively, though, is how much protection it really is providing you if you're living immediately adjacent next to a freeway and you happen to have a tree in front of you. Whether it's actually going to provide you direct benefit is still kind of, the jury's still out on that. A lot of the studies that have been done in that area are from the East Coast, where they have a kind of a different landscaping materials, different trees. They tend to cluster them closer together. There have also been some studies that have been done locally, some limited studies that have shown that sometimes you might have a tree and that it perhaps it's even trapping some of those pollutant areas behind that tree. So, and again, based on some of the comments I made at the very beginning about the way the particles move about, that putting a tree in front of an area, again, lots of benefits of landscaping, I don't want to deny that, but again, from in terms of their role in specifically improving the air quality around these ultrafine particles specifically to a residential project is still kind of undetermined, and we are actually beginning some conversations with AQMD and some of the folks at some of our research facilities here as maybe there's an opportunity to kind of work together to see if we can do some more kind of site-specific studies to look into that. But again, right now it is challenging. We also know that Sometimes people have put in kind of physical barriers like walls. Again, that provides some of the same challenges that, again, those particles, the wall might be of a certain height, the building may be taller, a building may be actually lower relative to the elevation of the freeway. Again, those particles move about. Or sometimes if there's a gap in that wall, it'll funnel all those particles to that gap, and then you may actually concentrate the amount of particles flowing into a specific area in between those walls. So again, just a challenging conversation. Filters have been kind of proven to be effective in terms of helping with the indoor air quality. We have already put in place a requirement that all mechanically ventilated buildings within 1,000 feet of a freeway do need to include the MERV 13. Obviously, the effectiveness of them really does rely on how frequently they are cleaned or maintained, and we have already begun conversations with our colleagues in the Housing Community Investment Department about ensuring that their inspectors, when they go out and look at multifamily projects, can try, at least for the communal filters, can help better educate the managers of those buildings. So this kind of brings us to, I think, in some ways, the more challenging part of the conversation, which is around land use. Again, one of the two areas the Center for Disease Control pointed out. But again, it brings up the challenge of balancing the multiple objectives we have as a city in terms of meeting, you know, housing. We also know that many of our transportation network improvements that we're putting in some ways are oftentimes located right near the freeway. I mean, the Exposition Light Rail Line is a good example of that. So we're putting transit, sometimes it's also right in proximity to freeways, but we also know that's a really great place to provide housing and other kinds of things. The city has a number of policies, though, already that speak to the value and the importance of air quality, and a number of those are included in our current ZI. We have a couple of policies around this topic that were included in the recently adopted Plan for Healthy Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and we are suggesting that those be added to the ZI. And obviously, planners have access to any of the policies in the general plan when they're putting together findings, but putting them in the ZI just helps kind of elevate and increase awareness of those as potential tools. Should we find ourselves looking at a project that we might find that we want to condition against having the housing near the near the freeway. There are a couple of things with our zoning code. When we obviously, while we have some zones along the freeways that are zoned for residential, we do have zones today that are, you know, commercial, manufacturing, that are along freeways. And we are certainly looking through the recode of continuing having a zoning package that would not include residential. So therefore, community planners going forward, when they're doing community plan updates, would be able to look at these issues holistically and really help determine, you know, what would be the right, you know, kind of zoning or land use package to have in those particular areas. Because again, they're able to look at, again, all the kind of considerations, the freeways, the transportation system, and other kind of uses. And then just back to how we reduce reduce mobile source emissions. I mentioned earlier the vehicle charging stations. Obviously, you guys have really been a leader already on this topic with your requirement of the 20% of parking spaces EV ready and the 5% installed. Just wanted to point out the California code requires that 3% of parking spaces be EV ready, and they're looking to update that in 2020, and our building and safety department is certainly prepared to engage in those conversations to follow that, because we want to continue to kind of push the state to go even more aggressive. We as a city actually already are moving beyond the state. While the state has the 3%, we've got it's a little bit complicated in terms of the table in terms of land use, but typically on average about 5% of parking spaces are required to be EV ready, and then for residential projects there's a proportional amount of actual chargers that have to be installed. The city has also been doing some work in our public space on our civic projects, our libraries and other places, as well as in our park, on our on-street parking places, to actually put kind of EV chargers to, again, try to enable the build-out of the EV kind of infrastructure system that is obviously critical in order to encourage people to purchase and use EV vehicles. So just a couple other strategies I wanted to just point out in closing. Oops. clearly technically challenged here this morning. Just to kind of wanted to point out one of the other things we're looking at on our as part of our six strategies. We have the ZI already, which now requires us to notify projects that are coming to us for discretionary action. We're looking to actually expand it to include all discretionary actions as opposed to applications above the, right now it just includes the ones that are listed below. Just a minor thing. We're also looking to expand the design guidelines that are currently in the ZI right now. We already have in there. Again, we require that we locate open space as far away from the freeway. And there's a note in the ZI that talks about trying to perhaps consider reducing operable windows adjacent to the freeway. Although I would point out that, again, windows are not a barrier for, or even walls are not necessarily a barrier for these particles. So we have to kind of balance providing or not providing, you know, daylight and into built units. Also, you might have a unit that's really high above the freeway and may not be as impacted. So just not having operable windows along the freeway is not necessarily a solution. We're also looking at establishing healthy building design guidelines. This was established in the Plan for Healthy Los Angeles Essential Program, and it's an opportunity for us to, again, try to spend some time this summer delving deeper into this topic and seeing if there's any other things we could do in terms of buffers and other kinds of things to try to get people just further away from the freeway and how we site a project. I think that's it. Shauna, have any comments, final comments?
I'm sorry, can you go back to the, leave it on the slide about the EV parking? Just go back. Sorry, Shauna.
Shauna, anything you wanted to share?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Eager to hear questions.
Great. Before we do, we're going to open up the conversation to the public testimony. For those that filled out a speaker card are going to be able to address the commission with their thoughts and comments on this presentation. The only card I have is from Doug Haynes. Doug, come on up. Good morning, sir. Doug, you're only speaker, so we'll provide 3 minutes to you.
I'll try to be brief. My name is Doug Haynes. I'm with the East Hollywood Neighborhood Council. I want to say with all due respect, the science in this matter could not be clearer. Fine particulate matter passes directly from the lungs into the bloodstream. It readily passes through door jams and window frames. There is no effective way to stop its penetration into residential housing. Living within 500 feet of a freeway results in double the rate of autism, double the rate of dementia, double the rate of cardiovascular disease, and a lifelong reduction in lung capacity for children ages 10 through 13. In East Hollywood, children live next to freeways. They are forced to attend schools for their entire K through 12 education next to freeways. And their only park, Lemon Grove Park, is right next to the 101 freeway. We are also crisscrossed by major highways of Santa Monica Boulevard and Western Avenue. And we also have the off ramps and on ramps for the 101 freeway. The staff report says, quote, it is not feasible to limit residential uses in these areas, unquote. Why not? The government exists to protect the most vulnerable among us. My neighborhood already includes some of the most densely populated census tracts in the United States. The zoning is R4 and R5. To ignore the consequences of putting more people next to freeways harkens back to the government's complicity in allowing lead and asbestos to remain in consumer products, even though the dangers are well known. It's shameful, and we can do much better. I will also point out that even if you eliminate vehicles that are gas powered, you still have the problem of road dust, which is created also by brake dust and by tire dust. So no matter what, you have fine particulate matter that surrounds the population within these areas and has very dangerous effects on their long-term health. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug. All right, at this time, I'm going to close public testimony and open up the conversation to commissioner questions and deliberations. And again, at this point, this is an informational matter. So I want to remind folks we're not necessarily voting today, but it has been a topic of conversation. I think we all have in various ways wrestled with projects in this space. So may I start with you, Vahid, with any questions or comments?
I have none.
Okay. Veronica Padilla Campos?
I don't have any questions. This is really hard, you know. And your presentation was very helpful and clear. I think we're just going to continue struggling through this for a little while longer, but thank you.
Yeah. Renee Dake Wilson.
This is Renee Dake Wilson. I agree greatly with what Doug Haynes said in our public comment, that it is really difficult and horrible to have residences or lots of breathing, anyone breathing freeway air. I think that that's why we're talking about this so much. And I'm appreciative of the ZI, and I think this is great to have our information, but what I would ask is I would push for regulation of this. And that's not what we're doing here today, but I think I have some things that I'm going to put out there for any legislators listening of what they want to do. I think that we need, one way we could go about this is provide a list of incentives, or not incentives, opportunities, such as maybe you put up a wall, maybe you put up a screen, maybe you have a greater air filter, maybe, you know, you find your variety of potential modifications to your design to decrease air quality. Because we can't say one of these is an end-all be-all because of site-specific conditions, prevailing winds, various issues that come up about the specific projects, but I think perhaps a menu to choose from would be a really good way to go about it, that so that we could have some ideas at our fingertips and keep that keep us cognizant of that at all times, but that we could have 4 out of 6 to choose from. Choose out of 6 in this list. I bet my experience from things like that is that everybody chooses 2 of those on the list that all the time, and then 4 of them are hard fought. 4 of them cost dollars. And it's important to require them. Yes, Jenna Bonston.
Hello. You may have seen in the bottom of the report, we
yes,
have a series of recommendations. And so
yes.
What I'm hearing you discuss is item 5, which is this idea of DCP to develop healthy building design guidelines.
Yes.
But I'm hearing you also say something a little bit more robust than just guidelines, but that you would be kind of selecting from a menu of options that could be chosen based on site-specific issues.
Yeah, well, science has said that there are these certain ways that we can make improvements. So if we can require these adjacent to properties, that might be a way to go further rather than just say, we hope you will take into account air quality. We've done that to a certain extent with Cougou, with Clean Up Green Up and requiring of MERV 13 air filters. And I brought today this wonderful 11 by 17 you created for us. Discussing, it's a document dated December 8th, 2016. It was a City Planning Commission report on MERV filter comparisons.
Yes, my legacy work.
It's really, I think it is. I think this is where it's at. And anybody can look that up. It's a, you could go to our presentation or our meeting, listen to that meeting from, I think it's December 8th, 2016. It might be a day after that. Maybe you wrote the report one day after, but at City Planning Commission, we had that presentation, and if we could codify that these are required and allow the applicant to make project design choices based on things that we know work but are also site-specific, that might be a good way to go about it. Also about, we've talked a lot about, maybe I'm just going to say some of those issues that are for example. We talked about decreasing operable windows and doors in freeway-facing developments. I would also add to that HVAC air intakes. I know, as we've discussed here, that we're having these small particles go through the cracks in the walls and stuff like that. But if you're going to have an operable window right next to the freeway, then that air is going to be override any MERV filters that we've installed, and you're just going to have a room full of bad air in there. So that's why we want to decrease those operable windows. That's why we want to decrease the number of balconies and outdoor amenities facing the freeways. Another option for legislative action would be perhaps incentives or dollars for filter maintenance, as stated in the MERV 13 filter guideline. Changing out those filters is really how it works, and what could also be added to that would be adding filtration systems to all the existing infrastructure that's there right now and was built before we started talking about this so much. If you're going to have all these adjacent buildings, I mean, at the City Planning Commission, we're allowed to consider projects that come before us. We're not allowed to retroactively go in. But there are all those buildings that are there before the CUGU requirements, before MERV air filters were installed, and that is a significant investment on those building owners, by those building owners, that needs to be incentivized and added to those. I also wonder if something we couldn't do is have visible monitors for the levels of air quality built into buildings, that for the new building you install something that shows a different color light depending on the air quality, or just a day-to-day sensor. You know, today in June gloom we have a lot of fog, so the air quality is bad when we have all the fog, and then it gets flushed out in the afternoon and we get a little cleaner. So if we can have visible monitors, perhaps that is something that's, I don't know, I'm spitballing here, but perhaps those are things that are easy to install on new buildings, but would help some of those adjacent historic environments and structures. Claire Bowen?
Just kind of actually going to add that when we were looking at these healthy building design guidelines, the Well Institute has actually developed something very similar to that. And maybe to that point, what they're finding is, and this maybe speaks to the operable window discussion, is that there are days that even near the freeways that the air quality is better because of the certain conditions. And so on those days, that's why you want to be able to have that operable window so you can allow that fresh air. People really benefit from fresh air coming in. But then again, you'd have those monitors so you would know that when the days are particularly bad outside, that those windows should remain closed. So again, you're giving information to the residents in those. It's an excellent idea.
That's great. And also it would help, again, those existing buildings that are really not getting any investment and that we don't get to see at the Department of City Planning or Building and Safety. Those are just buildings sitting there. But that would really provide information to the adjacent residents. Other things that we can do is require more, you talked in your six recommendations about more green building measures, and if we can certainly more encouragement of LEED standards, but also heading on over to the passive house standards, which is not just dealing with houses, it's a more net zero energy requirement that not only our energy is requiring, but our building code is heading toward. A lot of California building code is really robust on green issues and is heading that way, such that we're having a hard time meeting our Title 24 requirements on projects, which is great. It's kind of what needs to happen, but it's hard and it's expensive, but that we can look for outside requirements for ways to get there for our green building materials, that those LEED standards and passive house standards have some items that we can draw from, hopefully. And I also brought my Resilient LA. I was thinking, I haven't read this whole thing yet, but surprise. But maybe there's something in there that allows for commingling of, like you recommended the Healthy Los Angeles Plan for a Healthy Los Angeles.
Healthy Building Design Guidelines.
Thank you. Maybe that's another place that we have a way to cross-reference and implement together these issues, because I think this is an issue of resiliency in Los Angeles, that our long-term health and sustainability in Los Angeles, in this valley with hot air, anyway, that we can just bolster reference of that. I also was thinking about health risk assessments. I think any time that we condition, oftentimes community groups will ask for a health risk assessment. I would ask that we not only ask for the health risk assessment, but that we also require implementation of the recommendations. A health risk assessment is great, but it just points out the problems. And I want, anytime we ask for it to take that one step further to require some implementation, and I think that might require some legislative action, but perhaps Shanna Bonston.
Yes, so as you mentioned health risk assessments, actually one of our recommendations was to remove that as a requirement, because what we were finding in practice, although they do provide information, some of them actually recommended levels below what our requirements are. Yeah. So we were not finding the result as beneficial or consistent.
I love that you looked at the information that you got and you came up with that result, and I completely agree. I think that's great. And so if you can, I take staff's recommendation as the word. That's the word on the street. And the last thing I wanted to talk about was about oil drilling and air quality, that we're approaching that from the Department of City Planning standards about what to do about adjacent buildings to oil drilling and the negative effects of air quality there. If there's anything we can learn from that discussion to impact what we're doing on freeway adjacent development at the same time, and putting that into our policy would be great. But mostly my impression is whatever in this can be codified and required, the better, because we at the Planning Commission see a small percentage of buildings, and the we can require it. Sometimes it's removed by council members by the time it gets to them, and then our effects are for naught, such as EV parking standards. If you're removing EV parking, if you're removing solar, I saw a project of ours that we approved a permeable parking lot that I visited last week. It is not a permeable parking lot, and has LA Football Club, has very few EV chargers, which was not what we required at this Planning Commission. When you have projects like that that are removing things that we require at Planning Commission, you have council members that are taking out requirements. So until those things are codified and kept in there, we're not making the effect. And the Planning Commission sees such a small percentage of the projects, it really needs to be spread citywide. We can change the discussion. We can have all this time on the microphone, but it doesn't get implemented until it's really codified. Thank you.
Samantha Millman?
How do I follow that?
Carefully.
Ditto. Thank you. That was wonderful. And I agree with Renee's recommendations as well.
Mr. Mitchell?
So in the time that we've been discussing this issue over a few different meetings, I've had a chance to speak with a couple of experts and do some extra reading on this. And, you know, as presented by the public commenter, consistently I hear, you know, how scary this science is, right? This is a problem. So to Renee's point, the more that can be codified, the better. This is difficult because, you know, in these freeway adjacent spaces, no one wants to build necessarily buildings or schools or parks. You kind of run out of categories to try to serve these areas. So for me personally, I'm going to find it difficult to support projects that are freeway adjacent unless real measures are taken and the guidelines followed and actually implemented on a site-specific basis. And to Renee's point, actually implemented in the finished product. In this case, this is very important. These are real health issues, and the only way to move forward is going to be to address them head on, to try to codify as much as possible and require on a case-by-case basis measures that make sense for those specific sites that can help protect the people who are going to be living, working, playing in those sites.
I just want to add a couple things. So I think there's a couple vehicles with which we can approach some of the problem. So my initial thought, for instance, was community plans. As we look at community plans, in essence, we are examining zoning. So we are slated to review the vast majority of them in short order. So I encourage staff, as you look at the community plans and develop policy recommendations for the land adjacent to freeways, that's one area we could begin to mitigate recommendations of. For instance, if it's suggesting housing, we may want to think about that. I don't know what the approach would be from a systematic, but we're about to basically examine the whole city again. I know we just finished three, which is unfortunate, which is fortunate and unfortunate in this instance. But let's look at concrete ways we can do that. I don't know how we would go about other things. I like Renee's idea around making, as you suggested, making some of our approaches more citywide because of the slim number of cases we see amongst. So I was thinking, for instance, we do have the ability to initiate policy as a body. So for instance, to the conversation Samantha and we had today, why don't we up the EV parking? That's something that we could look at initiating to decrease the number of cars on the road. And again, it's not a one silver bullet solution, but we are not powerless in this instance. So I think this is the first start of a lot of conversations, but I was thinking of the community plans, initiating some of this law around EV or policy recommendations. And I know the city is doing other things, for instance, to decrease the urban heat trap or heat effect, I believe it's called, or heat island, with things like colored paving and things of that nature. It's not going to solve, but I think there are initiatives that we could look at. So for instance, when we're looking at projects, are there things of that nature that we can do to improve in the environment in ways that we've not thought of previously? I also wonder, I need to go back and read Clean Up, Green Up. What in that can we do more of? And I think I need to review that at some point myself. But I do think we're not powerless, so maybe some of the outcomes that you've described, I would only add, including in the community plan thinking and process, helping us understand the ability or inability or how we might expand some of the efforts that we've started here around EV. I know the city may get to it in 2020, but we're not a powerless body in the charter. We can initiate something sooner to really spur the conversation after some thoughtful recommendations. And then how do we amplify city efforts around policies they're implementing, like the colored pavement? I don't know. But if they had a recommendation of things that we could do. So for instance, we approve a lot of driveways. Why are they black? So we could make a voluntary request to developers that you can't pave with black tar anymore. But what are the things that we can do to contribute? That's one example. But over time, I believe we can begin to help address the problem from our current perch. Shauna, did you want to say something?
I did. In terms of Kugu, one of the things that we found is we were delighted to find how actually strong it was initially. So in looking at the original language and that it does require from a code perspective, the maintenance and installation of those MERV filters. So part of our follow-up work is mentioned by Claire, working with HCID on the inspections.
Great.
So it is in the books, in the law, and it's just a matter of making sure that's implemented.
And then maybe the conversation with that is expanding and making sure that we're doing something that I think Doug's comments and the statistics I sort of knew, but are startling to hear read aloud, and to have a hand in an asbestos or lead-like approach is really disheartening, balancing out that we are a city of laws and a nation of laws, and we have to follow those laws. So let's change some of the laws. So thank you for the presentation. With that, I think, Vince, if I could recommend maybe ongoing follow-up within some periodic time. I think we have some concrete requests maybe to understand how this might be implemented, for instance, in Clean Up, Green Up, and then maybe initiate something around EV, and then maybe some standard conditions like pavement. But I'm open to whatever the dynamic department thinks. With that, I have no further business for the City Planning Commission. We are at 11:30 a.m., and I'm going to adjourn us. Thank you, everybody. Great presentation. Thank you both.